actual ICE enforcement action, the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition has a hotline. That number is 1-888-622-1510. So that's going to be the resource that will get you most immediately connected to legal observers and to on-call legal support.
Great. Thanks so much. We've been talking today with Jordan Cunnings about the Alien Enemies Act and about what's going on right now in this country regarding the detention of undocumented workers and other people. Jordan, thank you so much for joining us today on Prison Pipeline.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host, and I'm also the current president of the board of directors here at KABU. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KBOO Community Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. In short, the period was very much like the present period.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello. Hello. 1, 2, 3.
Hello, my name is TK Kapurai and I'm an immigrant from Zimbabwe. I'm the host of the Global Cell, which airs live in the air room the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. I host immigrants and refugees from various global spots. I like to bring out their lived experiences so the world can know something about them. I like to bring a lot through my guests so we may have diverse experiences, cultures, foods, music, interests, and anything on the platform. We can share and learn a lot through their live instructions. Let's do this together, not only for a better platform for our community, but a better community for our platform. Again, tune in for my show, The Global Cell, live in the air room, the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and also available on the web at kboo.fm.
In times of turmoil.
Hard knock, hard knock, hard knock radio. Hard knock radio.
It's all good.
That you got a new generation of black people in this country who don't care anything whatsoever about us. They don't want to hear you old Uncle Tom handkerchief heads talking about the odds. No. This is a new generation.
An old woman can sit. An old man can sit. A chump can sit. A coward can sit. Anything can sit. Well, you and I have been sitting long enough, and it's time today for us to start doing some standing and some fighting to back that up.
Whites can help us, but they can't join us. There can be no black-white unity until there is first some black unity. We cannot think of being acceptable to others until we have first proven acceptable to ourselves. Concerning nonviolence, it is criminal to teach a man not to defend himself when he is the constant victim of brutal attacks. There are problems in the community. Some of the examples of those problems are the vices that destroy the moral fiber in our community. Drunkenness, drug addiction, prostitution, organized crime that robs the Negro community of probably 90% of its economic potential and moral potential. One of my reasons for going out on the limb as I have is to try and make white people be shocked awake to some of their senses, because if they don't awake, they're going to find out that this little Negro that they thought was passive has become a roaring, uncontrollable lion right at their doorstep, inside their house, in their bed, in their kitchen, in their attic, in their basement. And if you know that in time, you can do something about it.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me, us. We want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand. We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed, that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is us. We're her problem. The only reason she has a problem is she doesn't want us here. And every time you look at yourself, be you black, brown, red, or yellow, a so-called Negro, you represent a person who poses such a serious problem for America because you're not wanted. Once you face this as a fact, then you can start plotting a course that will make you appear intelligent instead of unintelligent. What you and I need to do is learn to forget our differences. When we come together, we don't come together as Baptists or Methodists. You don't catch hell because you're a Baptist, and you don't catch hell because you're a Methodist. You don't catch hell because you're a Methodist or a Baptist. You don't catch hell because you're a Democrat or a Republican. You don't catch hell because you're a Mason or an Elk. And you sure don't catch hell because you're an American, because if you was an American, you wouldn't catch no hell. You catch hell because you're a black man. You catch hell, all of us catch hell for the same reason. So we are all black people, so-called Negroes, second-class citizens, ex-slaves. You are nothing but an ex-slave. You don't like to be told that, but what else are you? You are ex-slave. You didn't come here on the Mayflower. You came here in a slave ship, in chains, like a horse or a cow or a chicken. And you were brought here by the people who came here on the Mayflower. You were brought here by the so-called pilgrims or founding fathers. They were the ones who brought you here. We have a common enemy. We have this in common. We have a common oppressor, a common exploiter, and a common discriminator. So once we all realize that we have this common enemy, then we unite on the basis of what we have in common. And what we have foremost in common is that enemy, the white man. He's an enemy to all of us. I know some of you all think that some of them aren't enemies. Time will tell. In Bandung, back in, I think, 1954, was the first unity meeting in centuries of black people. And once you study what happened at the Bandung Conference, and the results of the Bandung Conference, it actually serves as a model for the same procedure you and I can use to get our problem solved. At Bandung, all the nations came together. There were dark nations from Africa and Asia. Some of them were Buddhists. Some of them were Muslim. Some of them were Christian. Some of them were Confucianists. Some were atheists. Despite their religious differences, they came together. Some were communists, some were socialists, some were capitalists. Despite their economic and political differences, they came together. All of them were black, brown, red, or yellow. The number one thing that was not allowed to attend the Bandung Conference was the white man. He couldn't come. Once they excluded the white man, they found that they could get together. Once they kept him out, everybody else fell right in and fell in line. This is the thing that you and I have to understand. And these people who came together didn't have nuclear weapons. They didn't have jet planes. They didn't have all of the heavy armaments that the white man has. But they had unity. They were able to submerge their little petty differences and agree on one thing, that though one African came from Kenya and was being colonized by the Englishmen, and another African came from the Congo and was being colonized by the Belgian, and another African came from Guinea and was being colonized by the French, and another came from Angola and was being colonized by the Portuguese, when they came to the Bandung Conference, they looked at the Portuguese, and at the Frenchmen, and at the Englishmen, and at the other Dutchmen, and learn or realize that the one thing that all of them had in common, they were all from Europe. They were all Europeans, blonde, blue-eyed, and white-skinned. They began to recognize who their enemy was. The same man that was colonizing our people in Kenya was colonizing our people in the Congo. The same one in the Congo was colonizing our people in South Africa and in southern Rhodesia and in Burma and in India and in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. They realized all over the world where a dark man was being oppressed, he was being oppressed by the white man. Where the dark man was being exploited, he was being exploited by the white man. So they got together under this basis, that they had a common enemy. And when you and I here in Detroit and in Michigan and in America, who have been awakened today, look around us, we too realize here in America, we all have a common enemy. Whether he's in Georgia or Michigan, whether he's in California or New York, he's the same man. Blue eyes and blonde hair and pale skin. Same man. So what we have to do is what they did. They agreed to stop quarreling among themselves. Any little spat that they had, they'd settle it among themselves. Go into a huddle. Don't let the enemy know that you got a disagreement. Instead of us airing our differences in public, we have to realize we're all the same family. And when you have a family squabble, you don't get out on the sidewalk. If you do, everybody calls you uncouth, unrefined, uncivilized, savage. If you don't make it at home, you settle it at home. You get in the closet, argue it out behind closed doors. And then when you come out on the street, you pose a common front, a united front. And this is what we need to do in the community and in the city and in the state. We need to stop airing our differences in front of the white man. Put the white man out of our meeting, number one, and then sit down and talk shop with each other. That's all you gotta do.
It's Hard Knock Radio, Baby D, hanging out with you this afternoon. The voice you just heard is a familiar one. It is that of Elhaj Malik Shabazz, a.k.a. Detroit Red, a.k.a. Malcolm Little, a.k.a. Malcolm X. Today would have been his 100th birthday, and I figured let me start off the show with an excerpt from a very famous speech, Message to the Grassroots. And that is a landmark speech. It's one of his many landmark speeches. He covers a lot of ground.
And I just thought that would just kind of warm you up a little. I was thinking, who could I get to come on the show to talk to us about Malcolm? There's a lot of people. Some people knew him. Some people have written articles. Some people study him. Some people teach him. I said, let me go to one of our comrades, Jared Ball, from our sister station in Washington, D.C. Has his own network, you know, and he's also the author of a book, you know, correcting the lies of Malcolm X. Him and Todd Burrows did that. I think I might have messed up the title, but I'll let you correct me on the title, Jared. But welcome to the show. I thought on his 100th birthday, I wanted to get some of your insights because you really had to do some deep dives into Malcolm, and I think you have just as much insight as many others at this point in time.
No, so first of all, it's always a pleasure to join you and to be back with Pacifica and on Hard Knock Radio, the legendary program that it is. So thank you very much. You know, so listen, the book is a lie of reinvention, correcting Manning Marable's Malcolm X, co-edited by me and Dr. Todd Stephen Burrows, has a number of great contributions in it, from some brilliant thinkers, people who, as you point out, knew Malcolm, worked with Malcolm, but also studied and carried on his legacy. And, you know, so, and the overall point of the book is to challenge not only just the one book that Manning Marable and Viking Press produced in 2011, but to really engage the ongoing battle for the memory and the brand of Malcolm X. And there's, I think, been a lot of effort put into rebranding Malcolm so that when the symbol that he continues to represent is considered and picked up, it will be done so in a way that doesn't become a threat to those in power. And it just reminds me of something, you know, that Harold Laswell, one of the so-called founding fathers of this, the modern mass communications research environment. He said in the 1920s of the role of propaganda, the point is to not change the conditions people face, but to change their opinion of the conditions they face. So in other words, we're not going to stop oppressing you. So when you pick up your revolutionary ideas and symbols, and in this case, Malcolm X, we just want to make sure that since he's too big to fail, we can't erase him. We just want to make sure that you pick him up in a way that doesn't adjust your political or public opinion in such a way that you become a Malcolm X or someone who acts like or thinks like Malcolm X. So as we commemorate his 100th birthday, I've just wrapped up a 13-week 100 Years of Malcolm X series on Black Liberation Media. We literally just finished it a couple hours ago, that series. And during those weeks, it's been a great chance for me to revisit a lot of not only Malcolm's ideas, but some of the scholarship and what has been written about him and how he's been remembered and not remembered. And then also to just, I'll wrap here by also to remember that he worked in solidarity with a number of other people, including someone he shares his birthday with, the late, great Yuri Kochiyama, right, as well as Ho Chi Minh and Lorraine Hansberry. So among other, so this is a revolutionary day, and Malcolm was himself a revolutionary, and it's always good to remember that.
Yeah, I'm glad you reminded us about the shared birthdays. We did a whole special on Friday about Yuri, because of course they had the big conference up in Harlem.
That's right.
You know, to bring attention to the solidarity, keyword solidarity. As you were talking, Jared, I had to laugh a little because you talked about this thing where we change the opinion, right? And make Malcolm less of a threat. And, you know, people can't see you right now, but you have no hair. And I wonder if you lost your hair when they started to put Malcolm's picture right next to Barack Obama. And you remember those days? And, you know, it's like we came from, you know, there was like a long line of pictures, Marcus, Malcolm, Barack. And you're smiling now because you remember those things. And that's the type of, I think, opinion shifting that you're talking about. Am I right or wrong? And
oh,
then
no,
you
absolutely.
Get people that get into the academies that would also start to, you know, move Malcolm's rhetoric and legacy in ways that were kind of disingenuous, you know. And before long, you know, Malcolm is a kumbaya type of figure versus a revolutionary. So let's build on that, because this is not by accident, as you pointed out. It's very intentional. And I remember the association of Obama with Malcolm. And if you're listening to this speech in its entirety, man, their two policies and worldview just of the continent are
very
different.
When what alerted me more than anything when I first got Manning Marable's book was the epilogue. And if you read the end, the epilogue, you see that the 600 pages preceding it were meant to rebrand Malcolm in a way that he could be put in the political trajectory of a Barack Obama, where he's literally described as someone who would have been in political league, not only with Obama, but with Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. So, and my point then is as it is now. This isn't even an indictment or a criticism of Obama, Powell, or Rice. It is simply to say that their politics are antithetical to Malcolm X's. It doesn't matter whether you agree with Malcolm as I do, or whether you agree with Obama and others as some others do. The point is, they are not on the same political page. And that's just a historical fact. It doesn't matter, again, you could say one is right, one is wrong, but you just have to be honest and acknowledge that they are.
Let me ask you a quick question, because obviously I think I know, and obviously you know, but maybe somebody listening be well, Jared, what's the difference? What is the difference between Obama's policies, especially being, you know, his father being from the continent, and Malcolm X's political philosophy that would cause somebody to be upset if you align the two as callously as was done?
Well, you could, you know, one thing we could start with, it whether you are born on the continent of Africa or not, or whether you were born then or born today, there is still the question of, well, first of all, it doesn't matter where you're born. There's a question of what your politics are. So for Malcolm, the relationship to the continent of Africa was one more along the lines of people he was building with at the end of his life, including Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Touré, and in political lineage of the more recently at the time assassinated Patrice Lumumba, who themselves are arguing for a United States of Africa under scientific socialism. So they were arguing for the resources of Africa being shared among African people, with a common government, with a common defense, and a common redistribution of wealth, so that there was no inequality, there was no poverty, and there was certainly no more exploitation of their resources and labor by the West. So, again, the politics expressed by Barack Obama and the state of which he was leading, or that he was elected to lead, are obviously antithetical to that. That's sort of my point. This is obviously a capitalist, settler, colonial, white supremacist nation. It is in its interaction with the continent of Africa under Obama, as it was under the time when Malcolm was alive, was to exploit and extract and manipulate, and by today to run literally the militaries of the continent through AFRICOM. So what Malcolm, you know, and what we should be reminded of is I think it's interesting when you look at even the memoir of people like John Lewis, the late congressman, who said at the time in 1964, when he was the head of SNCC, when he traveled throughout the continent of Africa, every African leader that he met, and this is at the time of decolonizing Africa, this is a time of a very militant political leadership emerging, they told John Lewis, if you're anywhere to the right, politically right of Malcolm X, we don't want to deal with you. In other words, Malcolm had become the standard throughout the continent and throughout much of the world for Black liberation, for and as we were just reviewing earlier today with Dr. Orosami Burton and Hiram Rivera, a brilliant organizer whose idea it was for me to be doing the 13 weeks of 100 years of Malcolm X, you know, Malcolm had joined the only, again, Hiram reminded us this morning, the only organization Malcolm X joined other than the Nation of Islam was the Revolutionary Action Movement, RAM. He started the OAU, he started the Muslim Mosque, but the only other organization he joined other than the Nation of Islam was RAM. And what were RAM's politics? Urban guerrilla warfare, revolutionary nationalism and socialism, militant internationalism, and they were meant to be the underground component to Malcolm's above ground OAAU. These are the kind of, again, this is decidedly, you know, so this, well, more than maybe
that's
anything
important,
expresses
what you're
some differences. Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
that's important what you're saying, because the kumbaya-ing of
exactly.
Malcolm, you know, removes the fact that he did have, he was a revolutionary, and with that comes an understanding of militancy to get rid of oppression. Like, that is not written off the table. And I think the other trajectory is that him and Martin were aligning. And that may be the case in terms of how they looked at the world politically. But the assumption is that Malcolm was moving more towards the nonviolent stance, versus Martin maybe looking and saying, hey man, you know, I might have to pick up these guns, and I might have to join RAM with you. You know what
you
I'm
know,
saying? So
it's kind of funny, like Du Bois is often mischaracterized in a certain way, but he himself said during the Atlanta riots, you know, I took my shotgun and sat out on the front porch and said, the first white man that shows up is getting shot. King himself had arms and had to be reminded and told to put them away as part of the movement. Like, he was, his nonviolence, you know, direct action, which is the part people also often forget with King, was that he called for direct action. It was part of a movement. It wasn't necessarily even something he always, you know, he grappled with it, is my point. But to your point, absolutely, Malcolm and Martin were on ever radicalizing trajectories. And because I just finished reading at the inducement again of Hiram and Dr. Burton, if you go back and read Max Stanford, better known as Dr. Muhammad Ahmad, and his thesis as a member of the Revolutionary Action Movement, he wrote his master's thesis on that movement. And if you go back and read it, as we just did, he reminds that the tactic of RAM was to have Malcolm and others join more mainstream elements of the movement and sort of in a positive way, radicalize them, infiltrate them, and radicalize them. So Malcolm's increasing engagement with the mainstream civil rights movement, his going to Selma and trying to meet King when King was locked up, and meeting Coretta and speaking to the youth in the South and so on and so forth. Malcolm was trying, he was saying, he wasn't becoming more liberal. He was saying, we're needing to recruit and build a movement. So if I engage them, I can help bring them more to a more militant radical consciousness, which of course he was an expert at doing.
The Russian Revolution, what was it based on? Land, the landless against the landlord. How did they bring it about? Bloodshed. You haven't got a revolution that doesn't involve bloodshed. And you're afraid to bleed. I said you're afraid to bleed. Long as the white man sent you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, you bled. He sent you to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, you bled. You bleed for white people. But when it comes time to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got no blood. You bleed when the white man says bleed. You bite when the white man says bite. And you bark when the white man says bark. I hate to say this about us, but it's true. How you gonna be nonviolent in Mississippi as violent as you were in Korea? How can you justify being nonviolent in Mississippi and Alabama when your churches are being bombed and your little girls are being murdered, and at the same time you're going to get violent with Hitler and Tojo and somebody else that you don't even know? If violence is wrong in America, violence is wrong abroad. If it's wrong to be violent, defending black women and black children and black babies and black men, then it's wrong for America to draft us and make us violent abroad in defense of her. And if it is right for America to draft us and teach us how to be violent in defense of her, then it is right for you and me to do whatever is necessary to defend our own people right here in this country. That's right. Of all our studies, history is best qualified to reward all research. And when you see that you got problems, all you have to do is examine the historic method used all over the world by others who had problems similar to yours. And once you see how they got theirs straight, then you know how you can get yours straight. Please. There's been a revolution, a black revolution going on in Africa. In Kenya, the Mau Mau were revolutionaries. They were the ones who made the word Uhuru. They were the ones who brought it to the fore. The Mau Mau, they were revolutionaries. They believed in scorched earth. They knocked everything aside that got in their path. And their revolution also was based on land, a desire for land. In Algeria, the northern part of Africa, a revolution took place. The Algerians were revolutionaries. They wanted land. France offered to let them be integrated into France. They told France to hell with France. They wanted some land, not some France.
Let me ask you this, talking with Dr. Jared Ball from Black Liberation Media and also our sister station in D.C. That's where many of us got to first know him. Looking at, you know, since you just finished the 13-week series and you had this time to kind of reflect and look at this, on this 100th anniversary, this 100th birthday of Malcolm, I would be curious to see if his politics are raised up by the mainstream, if they even talk about him today and say happy 100th birthday to Malcolm X. And the reason why is because there are two big events, actually three, but we'll look at two that are, I think, top of mind. And I want to get your take on how you think he would be dancing with these scenarios. The first one, obviously, is with Burkina Faso, right? And I started off with the message to the grassroots. So it's a direct conversation on decolonization, right? So now we have black people, right, who hold high office, who are calling, you know, General President Ibrahim, you know, some sort of unscrupulous, you know, scandalous guy that needs to be removed from office. I mean, they're literally saying that here in the States, while millions of people all around the world, you know, are sitting up there, you know, cheering him on, including some black folks that I just seen the other day from France. They were here at the Malcolm X Jazz Festival saying, man, that brother's doing what needs to be done. So two very different opinions, the official state one and how people on the ground are feeling. But there would be a wrestling of Malcolm in an incident like that. Where does he stand when it comes to Burkina Faso? And then the other one, obviously, is Palestine. And, you know, we have the very famous incident. Big shout out to Reefa One, who we just had on to talk about Burkina Faso. When they were at SF State, they were asked to do a mural for Malcolm, and they did the mural, and they reminded people in that mural what Malcolm's position on Palestine was, and all hell broke loose. And to this day, you know, they covered up the mural and they erased it and they banned a bunch of people from coming on to the campus, you know, forever, you know, that type of deal, right? But where would he stand now? And is the politics that of some of the people who have been, you know, that are pro-Palestinian, are they aligned with Malcolm? Have they followed a trajectory, or have they radically moved in a whole other direction? So those are two things from your expertise.
I always hesitate and encourage people to hesitate in speculating about things like this. But I think in this case, it's pretty safe to do so, given the record is pretty clear. Malcolm was overtly, as I mentioned, on the side of all of the anti-colonial movements on the continent of Africa and beyond that were looking to decolonize from settler colonialism and imperialism. He was, as I said, he was a supporter of by any means necessary. He took it seriously. Radical uses of the vote, radical uses of civil disobedience, and engagement with armed struggle. He was very clear on this. So the idea that he would have, I think it's safe to say he would have absolutely been supporting Ibrahim Traore and all the struggle in the Sahel and the AES and all of those efforts. He would have been encouraging, as again, he was a supporter of Nkrumah's United States of Africa under scientific socialism effort. So it's and then similarly, when it comes to Palestine, he was explicit. In this case, we don't have to speculate, unless the speculation is to suggest that something would have changed between then and now in his, but based on what he said at the time, he, especially at the end of his life, he was absolutely equating the struggle of black. This is something, let me just finish that. He was absolutely equating the struggle of black liberation here to the decolonization efforts, the anti-colonial efforts and movements throughout the continent of Africa, Latin America, and in Palestine. He explicitly sided not only as a Muslim, but as a black revolutionary with the struggle and the liberation of Palestine. He was overtly against Zionism. He was overtly against the dollarism, as he called it. He was overtly against the capitalism that was involved. So he was, but this is the one thing that I wanted to point out, that there are really three things that I wanted to make sure I pointed out that I've learned over or been encouraged to revisit in this 100 years of Malcolm X effort, right? And I'll start backwards with this last point we were making here. It is very clear that Malcolm, at the end of his life, was struggling to build the Organization of Afro-American Unity based on Nkrumah's efforts with the Organization of African Unity, and that this was the overt unifying element of a much more broad and militant black struggle that Malcolm was looking to be connected to, and as I mentioned, with Ram and others. And that he saw specifically, this is very important, that I think gets intentionally suppressed. Malcolm X saw Black America's liberation struggle as a national liberation struggle akin to all others, whether it was Ghana, Burkina Faso, or Palestine. So this is a very important and I think key nuance to understanding what Malcolm's efforts were. Black liberation was not about integration. It was not about civil rights. And it was, as he was saying, it was about human rights. It was a national liberation struggle. Secondly, he was clear that the black liberation struggle here in the U.S. was intimately linked to those throughout Africa, Latin America, and specifically those with Palestinian liberation. And then lastly, he was actively raised up initially in the context of African world radicalism that was brought in. He was brought into advanced political consciousness and working to make more room for the black women who performed all of that for him. In other words, his mother, Louise Little, who gets often erased, including by Marable in many ways, as the radical thinker that she was, a Garveyite till the end of her life into the early 90s, that this often gets ignored, and that it was other black women that helped move, like Vicki Garvin and Shirley Graham Du Bois and Alice Wyndham, and Maya Angelou, who moved Malcolm X into a higher stage of radical consciousness and internationalism. And then at the end of his life, he was looking to address the critical errors he and others had been making in terms of our treatment of women in the struggle, and looking to make sure that they had room to elevate to positions of leadership, et cetera, and so forth. So these three things, I think, are at minimum essential to be reminded of when considering Malcolm X, and they're often suppressed or omitted altogether.
Dr. Jared Ball is with us this afternoon as we are talking about the 100th birthday of Malcolm X. The other place where his image in politics is wrestled with is what I would describe as a very conservative, nativist type of movement that has emerged in many communities. In our community, the Black community, it's shown up under the banner of ADOS, American Descendant of Slaves, or Foundational Black Americans, where we don't deal with nobody. Haitians, Jamaicans, Puerto Ricans, nobody. It's just Black Americans, us and us only, right? So there's this whole thing, which, you know, shout out to you because you were one of the first to kind of talk about the right wing funding of those type of movements way back in the days, you know, and went and bought the receipts. But with that being said, Malcolm has been positioned as somebody who would have actually rejected and not have wanted to do any sort of dance or have any sort of alignment with somebody like Yuri Kuchiyama and, say, the Asian liberation struggle. He's somebody that would have frowned upon what is going on in Latin America and said, that's not our problem, right? And so there's been a move to downplay his internationalism and make it seem like he was just solely focused on Black Americans, using the OAA as proof. See, look, it doesn't say all Blacks, it just say Black Americans. So let's clarify that, you know, from the work that you've done. Again, and this is a very important and maybe more nuanced type of scenario, because it's secretly being funded and it's secretly being amplified behind the scenes by people, you know, that have these right wing views and, you know, and kind of don't want to see us make these connections.
So, you know, again, just to keep it, I think, as simple as possible, I think it's important to be reminded, again, we don't have to agree, but we have to be honest what the historical record is. So if folks want to make an argument that their destiny is tied exclusively to the United States and they want to make some sort of plea for reparations and they want to wrap themselves in an American flag, on some level, fine, enjoy yourselves. But to bring Malcolm into that is just disingenuous and is historically inaccurate. So you can say you don't agree with Malcolm, but to try to reappropriate him is diabolical. Malcolm was very clear. His mother, again, Louise Little, was from Grenada. His father, Earl, and his mother were active members in Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association, the very Pan-African, globally African, Black, biggest organization maybe ever. Malcolm himself said, if you know, repeatedly, if you don't understand your African history, you don't, you're a tree without roots. You know, his last efforts were building unity with the African world and the entire revolutionary world, decolonizing world. Yes, like many of us, he had a bias. He said he struggled to the end of his life. He was, in fact, we were just reading. I'm holding it up for you to see. I know the audience, you know,
Ghost in Our Blood.
Ghost in Our Blood from Jan Carew. And where he's talking about, you know, this is within a few weeks of his assassination. He's telling, Jan Carew is trying to tell him, like, Malcolm, you know, as did others. You know, if it's dangerous for you in the United States, go into exile somewhere, take a break, chill for a minute, go, you know. And Malcolm's saying, I can't leave the Black struggle. He was when he met Africans from America in the Africa, when he met Maya Angelou and them, he was telling them, you're doing great work here and building our connections, but you got to come home and help our folks at home. So it's not a matter of ignoring or denying some bias that we may have for our immediate starting point. But we have to recognize that Malcolm's clear tactical effort was that if you don't get assistance from people struggling against a common enemy, you're never going to be free. And to connect your destiny entirely to the nation that has enslaved you and colonized you and exploited you and imprisons you and kills you by the police and does, you know, with the police and does all of this, to wed your entire destiny to that exclusively is antithetical not only to Malcolm's politics, but I think to any, you know, thinking person. So again, ADOS is exactly backwards, both politically and in terms of its acronym. It should be SODA, Solidarity of Dispersed Africans. That's what Malcolm was aggressively working for. Again, even just tactically, it's this again, to your point about Kumbaya, he wasn't looking to be Kumbaya in the other way either. It wasn't just some, let's just all be Black and African and hang out together. His point was, if Africa's not free, we can't get free. If they're doing this to Palestinians, they're going to do it, and they are doing it to us. He was one of the first to call out the connection to the Vietnam War in terms mm-hmm. of what it was not doing and doing to Black people here in the United States. So again, as I was saying, people can make the argument if they want. It's just disingenuous. It's antithetical. It's unsupported by evidence to claim that Malcolm would have made some silly suggestion that we wrap ourselves in this flag and appeal for reparations in the most conservative. And then lastly, if you read the counterintelligence program documents, if you even read the Guardian newspaper article that came out, I think in 2022, they're openly admitting their primary concern, or among their primary concerns, was that Black people from the United States were connecting themselves to international struggles, and they wanted that destroyed. That one of their primary goals was the disunification of the continent of Africa so that the continued exploitation that we see today could continue. So and they explicitly said in the documents that every time Black people, in fact, Dr. King was even sought to be a threat in the eyes of William Sullivan and the FBI, because even after his "I Have a Dream" speech, which most people associate with, you know, softness, because they felt that King was going to bring Black people into solidarity with the Cuban Revolution of just a couple years before that. So this mm-hmm. idea that Black people will unite with other people is a constant threat to those in power. So just by default, it should be recognized that if your whole political project is sided up with the United States, that's exactly what they want. As a mechanism of suppressing and limiting that movement.
That's the voice and wisdom of Dr. Jared Ball. We appreciate you coming on and sharing with us these insights on this 100th birthday of El-Haj Malik Shabazz. If there's any two things you want people listening to build upon or to further research or to read, What would your recommendation? Is there a speech or anything that you say, check that out?
All of his speeches, you know. First, because even his earlier ones that are supposed to be, you know, in a more early political state of nature, so to speak. I mean, there's brilliance in all of them. Even so-called before he made his break with the Nation of Islam, he was so advanced in his thinking. The other thing, just very quickly, you mentioned something that I didn't address. There are new books coming out. There are those I would consider my political enemies. They are commemorating this 100th anniversary by promoting books with very popularly platformed and promoted spaces and publishing contracts that are looking again to rebrand Malcolm in a very safe way, because it's understood he's too big to suppress. So they have to get out in front and try. So what I would leave you with is that all of Malcolm's speeches, and then something that I was talking about earlier this morning that I need to change and improve on, revisit the Revolutionary Action Movement. You know, Hiram Rivera said something very important to us this morning, that if, you know, we say we honor people like Malcolm X, but we don't do enough to study the people that they studied. And to look at the movements that they looked to join. And again, the Revolutionary Action Movement was the last and only other organization that Malcolm joined beyond the Nation of Islam. And we don't study it enough. And there are very good reasons for it. And if people investigate some of that history, they'll see that the socialism, the revolutionary nationalism, the internationalism, the SODA politics, the consideration for armed struggle, and even urban guerrilla warfare, as uncomfortable as some of those ideas may make us, these were the ideas Malcolm was looking to grapple with. And if we want to be honest and fair to him, we need to revisit and consider some of those histories and ideas ourselves.
And one thing I will remind folks, since you mentioned the COINTELPRO papers, if you look at the COINTELPRO papers, It explains it very clearly. To dismantle and disunify militant organizations, don't allow them to get any sort of credibility within the community. And you know what's at the top of the list? RAM.
RAM.
RAM exactly. Is right there, followed by Dr. King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and then Nation of Islam and Black Panthers and a few others, but RAM is at the top of the list. So there you have it. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio on his 100th birthday of Malcolm X. Dr. Jared Ball, we appreciate you. We'll be right back.
To understand this, you have to go back to what young brother here referred to as the house Negro and the field Negro back during slavery. There was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food, what he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near their master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save their master's house quicker than the master would. The house Negro, if the master said, "We got a good house here," the house Negro said, "Yeah, we got a good house here." Whenever the master said "we," he said "we." That's how you can tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick? We sick?" He identified himself with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you came to the house Negro and said, "Let's run away, let's escape, let's separate," that house Negro would look at you and say, "Man, you crazy. What you mean separate? Where is there a better house than this? Where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this?" That was that house Negro. In those days, he was called a house nigger. And that's what we call him today, because we still got some house niggers running around here. This modern house Negro loves his master. He wants to live near him. He'll pay three times as much as the house is worth just to live near his master. And then brag about, "I'm the only Negro out here."
"I'm the only one on my job. I'm the only one in this school. You're nothing but a house Negro." And if someone come to you right now and say, "Let's separate," you say the same thing that the house Negro said on the plantation. "What you mean separate? From America? This good white man? Where you gonna get a better job than you get here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa." That's what you say. Why, you left your mind in Africa. On that same plantation, there was the field Negro. The field Negro, those were the masses. There was always more Negroes in the field than there was Negroes in the house. The Negro in the field caught hell. He ate leftovers. In the house, they ate high up on the hog. The Negro in the field didn't get nothing but what was left of the insides of the hog. They call them chitlins nowadays. In those days, they call them what they were. Guts. That's what you were, a gut eater. And some of you are still gut eaters. The field Negro was beaten from morning till night. He lived in a shack, in a hut. He wore cast-off clothes. and he hated his master. I say he hated his master. He was intelligent. That house Negro loved his master. But that field Negro, remember, they were in the majority. And they hated the master. When the house caught on fire, he didn't try and put it out. That field Negro prayed for a wind, for a breeze. When the master got sick, the field Negro prayed that he died. If someone come to the field Negro and said, let's separate, let's run, he didn't say, where are we going? He said, any place is better than here. You got field Negroes in America today. I'm a field Negro. The masses are the field Negroes. When they see this man's house on fire, you don't hear these little Negroes talking about, our government is in trouble. They say, the government is in trouble. Imagine a Negro, our government. I even heard one say, our astronauts. They won't even let him near the plant. And our astronauts, our Navy. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. Just as the slave master in that day used Tom, the house Negro, to keep the field Negroes in check, the same old slave master today has Negroes who are nothing but modern Uncle Toms, 20th century Uncle Toms, to keep you and me in check, keep us under control, keep us passive and peaceful and nonviolent. That's Tom making you nonviolent. It's like when you go to the dentist and the man is going to take your tooth. You're going to fight him when he starts pulling. So they squirt some stuff in your jaw called Novocaine to make you think they're not doing anything to you. So you sit there and because you got all that Novocaine in your jaw, you suffer peacefully. Blood running all down your jaw. And you don't know what's happening. Because someone has taught you to suffer peacefully. The white man do the same thing to you in the street. When he gonna want to put knots on your head and take advantage of you and don't have to be afraid of you fighting back. To keep you from fighting back, he get these old religious Uncle Toms to teach you and me. They're just like Novocaine, suffer peacefully. Don't stop suffering, just suffer peacefully. As Reverend Cleek pointed out, let your blood flow in the streets. This is a shame. And you know, he's a Christian preacher. If it's a shame to him, you know what it is to me. There's nothing in our book, the Quran, as you call it, Koran,
me say me ready for the road. Put me upon the radio, me ready for the road. We no come for players, so me touch the stage show. Fire dust and blaze, so them never they know. KBOO run the place, no, 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 yeah. Yeah, man, I'm gonna say this is the KBOO Full Strength Community Radio. And you know it's Kabaka Pyramid representing and full dancing. Baby Rock family, you don't know Kingston, Jamaica, we say. Yeah, Portland.
Camp KBOO is now in session. Sign up to support us during our summer membership drive now through June 29th. All you have to do is check out kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and support a summer of memories together.
By the mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down and wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
This is Bird Note. I'm Dara Miles Wilson.
Grief settles in the body like an overcast sky on a windless day. Heavy, unmoving. At least that's how it felt on the day of my cousin's funeral. On that June morning in Camden, South Carolina, the world felt hushed, aside from my family's tears. Our collective grief colored everything in lackluster gray. Well, almost everything. Shortly after the procession began escorting my cousin to his final resting place, I spotted a flash of vermilion. A red-headed woodpecker appeared mere yards away from me, the first one I had ever seen with my own eyes, or what birders call a lifer. Its vibrant colors were a bright spot on an otherwise dark day. Later, while I walked in the woods on my uncle's property at twilight, an eastern whippoorwill called out from the trees, steadfast and distinct, right as dusk thickened into night. Another lifer, another extraordinary gift. I didn't expect to find joy as I wandered in the wilderness that evening. But joy, as it turns out, appears before us in the most unexpected places at unpredictable times. As I remember my cousin, I hold tightly to this message from the birds I saw. Joy does not wait. It simply arrives, even in the midst of sorrow. For Bird Note, I'm Dara Miles Wilson.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information